Hello, everyone. Welcome to This Must Be the Place, the Building Science Podcast. I'm your host, Shauna Henderson. Each episode is a deep conversation with a carefully chosen peer about not just houses, but place. Yeah, of course we talk about houses and retrofits, but we also want to change the industry for the better, forever. Energy poverty, community engagement, industry disruption, societal responsibility, and climate change. It's all here and so much more. Welcome to Season 3 of This Must Be the Place, the Building Science Podcast. I'm your host, Shauna Henderson. With 36 great episodes under our belt, we decided to change things up a bit for this season. So our next 18 episodes will be broken into three themes, with six episodes per theme, and the first episode of each theme will start with an essay by me, followed by a chat with a guest to add their perspective on the theme. Of course, there's going to be overlap and layers of discussion because, you know, everything connected. The first theme is how we got here. We're going to lay out some history and context for the cold climate building science that we lean on to create today's high-performance housing in Canada. The second theme revolves around what we need to do to get out of our own way because, you know, we're kind of stuck right now. And the third theme is focused on disruptors, inspiration, and the future of building science and the residential construction industry. One of the reasons for this podcast is to try to record some of the key people and events that make up the history of Canada's contribution to building science and high-performance housing. Another reason is to push for the essential need for building science in all trades training and college programs that lead people into the construction industry, whether it's residential or commercial or industrial, because we're not building houses or any other buildings like barns anymore, and our training needs to reflect that. The thing that stands out to me with each of my guests, their stories, and the stories of the people I'll mention in this essay is that most of them kind of fell into the world of building science. So many of us come into this part of the industry tangentially as a builder, or as an engineer, or through a passion for reducing global footprints. It's a subject that people seem to bump into on a path that they were following in a different direction. The challenge is that building science is still viewed as an option in the industry when we really need the whole workforce to have a strong understanding of the dynamic relationship between the building envelope components, the mechanical systems, and the occupants. There's new materials, methods, and equipment to be developed, and we have some really big shoes to fill. In context, we're still taking baby steps, but we've come an awful long way in the last 50 years. So here we go. How did we get here? I'm going to start by reaching back, by reaching way back. Our understanding of heat, air, and moisture flows is nothing new. In the Neolithic period, Koreans developed sophisticated radiant floor heating systems in their homes. The Anasazi, living in southwest Arizona for the first 1,300 years of the Common Era, built dwellings to take advantage of passive solar. One of the first Western people to write about solar gain and the benefits of passive solar was Socrates. Vitruvius, a Roman architect and engineer during the first century before the Common Era, designed a passive ventilation system to reduce humidity in libraries to protect the scrolls. Around the globe, traditional forms of shelter and construction all grew from available materials, cultural norms, and social parameters. The examples I just shared are based on the physics, the observation of nature and experimentation with cause and effect. And here's the cool thing, physics is not scary. It's a natural science. It's the study of matter and its motion, its behavior through time and space, and how matter relates to energy and force. Physics is simply a mathematical way to describe those interactions. Nowadays, we have a far more substantial toolkit than, you know, Socrates or the Koreans in the Neolithic period. We have this toolkit that helps us to continually improve a measurable understanding of construction materials and equipment separately and in combinations. More importantly, we can test, monitor, and measure how the components of buildings and the people in them work as a system. Again, it's all connected. And, you know, we can't change the laws of physics either, so there's that. In a kind of parallel path, regulations for safety and fire protection, aka building codes, have been around since ancient times as well. The Code of Hammurabi dates from roughly 1772 BCE. Literally written in stone, it provides possibly the most stringent performance-based compliance path ever written. And I quote, "If a builder has built a house for a man and his work is not strong, and if the house he has built falls in and kills the householder, that builder shall be slain." Now, that's not really much of a driver for innovation, but it's a real good way to keep builders honest. For most of history, house construction has relied on the building envelope for protection from the elements. And codes were put in place to stop major disasters, like the 1666 Great Fire of London, from happening again, because the risk to adjacent buildings and the public simply grew larger as cities became more dense, with taller buildings being constructed closer together. And now we're going to fast forward to the 20th century. Here in Canada, the first version of the National Building Code was published in 1941. It was, like every code before it, a prescriptive path for fire and structural safety that included sections outlining requirements for light and ventilation, fire escapes, water supply, toilets and drains, stairs and railings. Building science as we know it today, and the building as a system concept, is a relatively new development that started in the 1960s. We started adding energy conservation measures like insulation to houses in the second half of the 20th century, with a supercharged effort starting in the 1970s because of the oil embargo. This changed how the house worked as a system and created all sorts of unintended consequences, but it wasn't until 2005 that our building code included energy efficiency measures. The first generation of Canadians who ushered in this new era of housing with insulation, air sealing, and ventilation is now gone, and the second generation is now moving into well-earned retirement or semi-retirement. That first generation of Canadian building scientists included Neil Hutchian, who became the director of the National Research Council of Canada's Division of Building Research in 1969, and Gus Handegord, who had a 35-year career with the same division and a long second career as a consultant and teacher after that. Hutchian and Handegord wrote Building Science for a Cold Climate in 1989, and nearly everything we do today in cold climate construction is derived from the research that backed up that book. During the 70s and 80s, spurred on by the oil embargo, Canada had an incredibly strong research community in physics, engineering, and housing, and some key visionary bureaucrats to guide it all. There were two core centers for research, with a lot of cross-pollination and collaboration between them. One formed around the National Research Council and CMHC in Ottawa, and the other formed around the Saskatchewan Research Council in Saskatoon. I want to start with what was going on in the West. The Saskatchewan Conservation House, or SCH, was a project developed at the request of the provincial government after the OPEC oil embargo of 1973. There were 11 team members, led by David Eyre. The team included Rob Dumont and Harold Orr, two names that you might recognize already. Built in 1977, the SCH was basically a playground/laboratory for building science nerds. The house was oriented for maximum solar heat gain in the winter, with integral shading to avoid overheating in summer. It was extremely airtight, had R40 walls, an R60 ceiling, and triple glazed windows, and was one of the first houses ever to have its fresh air supplied by heat recovery ventilation. Sound familiar? It should, because this project kicked off the R2000 program and was the proving ground for Passive House. And how did they know about the air tightness? Well, Harold Orr, environmental engineer with the National Research Council, was one of the first people to develop a blower door apparatus in the early 1970s. And how did they figure out heat recovery ventilation? Well, that was via Dirk Van Ee with the University of Saskatchewan Engineering Department. And how did they figure out the heating needs? Well, that was engineer and building scientist Rob Dumont, who worked with both the National Research Council and the Saskatchewan Research Council. He developed a couple of computer modeling tools. One determined furnace size, and another determined how much passive solar and other free energy might reduce heating costs. These two modeling tools became the basis for HOT 2000. So I'm going to back up a bit and fill in a few spaces. The University of Saskatchewan developed plans for an air-to-air heat exchanger based on the one built for the SEH. The plans were used by high-performance builders who would site-build one for each home. So you can imagine that there were wildly different results in performance. In the late 1970s, a few clever folks working on these newfangled high-performance houses recognized the need for an off-the-shelf unit. This resulted in a smaller, more effective, manufactured piece of equipment. And standardization, performance testing, improvements followed quickly. The initiative was led by Dirk Van Ee, instrumental in developing the heat exchanger in the SCH, and Rick Olmsted, who worked closely with the National Research Council of Canada. Rick was also a founding member of the North American Home Ventilating Institute, more commonly referred to nowadays simply as HVI. The Van Ee Olmsted team developed the unit. It hit the market in 1980 and became the design format for the North American ventilation industry. Meanwhile, in Ontario, we had Professor John Tomesk in the Department of Civil Engineering at the University of Toronto, teaching and mentoring a gang of up-and-coming building scientists, including that irrepressible rascal Joe Stiebrick, future leader of Building Science Corporation. Greg Allen, another engineer/architect out of the university, set up Canada's first solar collector manufacturing operation. Greg was also co-developer of one of the first heat recovery ventilators. And he was also president of the Toronto-based design build firm, Allen Drerup White Limited. ADW, as they were known, pioneered new design and construction techniques for low energy and passive solar houses. One of the ADW partners, builder Oliver Drerup, became the technical director of the R2000 program before he moved on to working with CMHC as part of their international team. The third member of ADW was CFO and lead designer Elizabeth White, who studied architecture at the University of Liverpool and McGill before deciding that 7 years plus required to do so was better spent actually building things. A woman after my own heart. That's exactly why I didn't go into architecture. Elizabeth was the author of the Enercan publication, Keeping the Heat In, which is used to this day as a key document for energy advisors, builders, renovators, and homeowners. Perhaps her most important contribution was the first advanced house in Brampton, Ontario, which spawned a number of further experiments and ultimately led to the Net Zero House program. Elizabeth was one of the very few women I'd heard of in this field in my early years, and she remains one of the most widely informed and experienced residential designers in the country.
When I think about it, I can only imagine the heady swirl of those days when tight groups of collaborators worked out their theories in real life. So much of what we take for granted in conventional home construction is from the last 50 years. And seeing as Canadians have been building houses for a couple of centuries now, we've got a few million houses to bring up to speed. In my career over the last few decades, I've been very lucky to work with and alongside some of the people who were key to advancing Canadian building science in the 70s and 80s. And some of those folks are my upcoming guests. I'm pulling on my own network and experience here, but I know there are all sorts of connections and many more great inside stories about how our industry has evolved, and I'm looking forward to searching them out. In the meantime, my first guest is Oliver Drerup. I met Oliver virtually at school when I had the Better Built Home video series on repeat for a whole semester. This series of 19 shows was produced by TV Ontario in 1987, and it was a fantastic introduction to the R2000 program. And the episode list reads exactly like all of the building science training programs that have followed it, starting out with designing for energy efficiency, using the principles and practice of building science, two complete episodes dedicated to foundations, an individual episode each for single stud walls, double stud walls, and prefab / manufactured housing, mechanical systems were explained in one episode, ventilation systems in another, and there was an episode each for heat recovery ventilators, heating systems, domestic hot water, and integrated systems. The series wrapped up with two really important topics: implications for the trades and marketing. Ironically, 35 years later, these two items are still in dire need of some really heavy lifting. In the shows, Oliver was the construction guy, and he had a co-host whose name was David Stringer. David was the setup man, asking the questions that allowed Oliver to start every answer with, "Let's go see, shall we?" My second guest in this theme is Don Fugler, one of the first people I worked with as an independent researcher. He taught me a lot about value, accuracy, and precision. Don was a senior researcher with CMHC, Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, for a large part of his career, with a focus on indoor air quality, existing homes, edge cases, and citizen science. I did several field research projects with Don, looking at energy use patterns in off-grid houses, moisture loading in straw bale walls, and moisture in seasonally occupied buildings. Under Don's direction, I wrote a whole series of About Your House publications on retrofitting house types and took a first swipe at modeling how to get net zero in existing housing across all Canadian climate zones. I got to do a lot of ridiculously interesting work, and I used Don's garbage bag airflow test protocol a lot. And for the straw bale project, we created moisture sensors from old film canisters, discarded piping and wiring from a dairy farm, and scrap from a woodworking shop. Don was also one of the people behind the first, and unfortunately last, renovation conference hosted by CMHC many years ago. Guest number three is Gail Lawler, president of Energy Matters. Gail and I met for the first time many years ago through Tex McLeod, Oliver Drerup, and another person who I haven't interviewed yet, Gord Cook. I think that each of them separately introduced us to each other at a single industry event with huge excitement, as we were two of the very few women actually working in the field at the time. And by in the field, I mean we weren't managing anything. We were actually energy auditors, etc. Gail came into the residential building science world about a decade before me, but from a different direction. Like so many of us, her path wound around a few corners, but grew from her environmental studies degree and a specialization in adult education. Her first iteration in this world was as co-owner of the Conservation Store, providing energy conservation products and information to homeowners and the industry. Other iterations of Gail include air sealing contractor, indoor air quality auditor, program manager, trainer, and mentor. Gail's been an active community organizer for more than 40 years, and her strengths in that area led her into training development and delivery, facilitation, research, and project manager in the energy, waste, and water sectors. I tell you, I can't keep up with her. When we're around each other, she goes at a pace. Her work as a trainer includes a comprehensive 40-hour House as a System / Building Science course delivered to hundreds, if not thousands, of people over the last 20-plus years. Much of her work in the last several years has focused on Indigenous communities in the North, bringing long-term, ongoing technical support for community programs, focusing on housing policy development, local skills capacity, and conservation demand management. Richard Kodelski is guest number four. I first heard of Richard through Terry Waters, my old boss, who originally owned sustainable housing here in Nova Scotia. Terry introduced me to Richard's publication, Soul Plan Review, in my first weeks of working with him back in 1991. I read it religiously after that, and I finally got to meet him in person in the mid-90s. Richard was instrumental in promoting the R2000 program and has been a longtime trainer of both builders and energy advisors. His contributions to the industry, on top of a few hundred issues of Soul Plan, include work with a wide range of building and energy code standing committees and task groups, as well as the Canadian Home Builders Association, the Architectural Institute of BC, and the BC Building On. My fifth guest in this segment is Ross Elliott. Until recently, Ross was owner of Home Soul Building Solutions. Over the years, we've worked in parallel paths that have crossed in working groups and at all sorts of great industry events. Ross came to Canada via Maine, where he started out in 1980 as an energy auditor. In 1983, he became a licensed carpenter and then meandered up into Ontario and dove into the industry here, where he spent two decades as a builder and renovator of energy-efficient, earth-friendly homes, including some of Canada's earliest R2000 houses. Working mainly in Ontario, Ross certified the first Energy Star home in Canada in 2005, and over the years, under his direction, more than 20,000 new and existing homes were labeled and quality assured through HomeSoul. Ross has won several awards recognizing excellence and lifetime achievement in energy efficiency and green building. In addition to all the field work he's done, he's also provided research and training for CMHC, Natural Resources Canada, the National Research Council, Xijing First Nation, and Ontario First Nations Technical Services. And he's been a regular sought-after presenter at many industry events. Today, I'm joined by Tex McLeod, another building science OG. He was one of the first R2000 trainers and a regular presenter at conferences and workshops when I was starting out in the field. Tex was also my guest on the podcast for episode 34 back in season 2, where we touched on some of the history behind Canadian building science and high-performance housing. I've asked him to join me today to help fill in some of the gaps. Thanks for coming back on the show, Tex. This is great. I know you've got a lot of experience and background with all the people I mentioned in my essay. I probably have a ton of things to say about them and other people that I didn't talk about.
Well, there was a whole lot of folks. There is no question. And one of the interesting things that came out of that is a whole training network and a whole training ethic in the housing.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, we still benefit from the learning and the understanding and the way things unfolded. There was the R2000 training team, then there became the CMHC housing training team, and then there became the renovation training team, and then there became an export housing team. And all the way along, each of the energy programs put another team together to do their training. So those initial investments in developing trainers started the whole network of training and trainers going.
Yeah, well, it certainly was I was right in that sweet time spot where I got the benefit of pretty much all of you. It was when Enercan was underwriting a bunch of the R2000 training. And we had a ton of people coming into Atlantic Canada to train, you included, and Oliver and the Enercan team, Charles Salim, and there's just so many names.
And one of the things that the Home Builders Associations did, which was ensure that there were trainers from their own territory doing training. So that mm-hmm. wasn't just people flying in.
Right.
Homegrown trainers that developed more expertise and understanding because they got the network with the whole group across the country.
Yeah.
And that was Terry, for me here, that was Terry Waters, who I worked with. So I just got to be in on everything. I feel really, really blessed to have been in that time frame.
Yes, you were with Terry in some pretty wonderful days of housing. And there was a bunch of money around. It wasn't, you know, there was money to do things and develop. Mm-hmm. And money got really scarce in the late 90s. And we sort of forgot our building science, and we let other parts of the world, especially the Americans, move forward. And we just hung around and didn't really invest in our own training until we started into the second energy crunch. And then we belatedly jumped back in again and started to do stuff. But in truth, we had the building science all our own. Our house as a system understanding was huge for folks around the world to understand. And that came out of Canada, absolutely came. The phrase came out of CMHC, and we still use that phrase across the country, you know, the house as a system.
Mm-hmm. Do we know who came up with it?
Well, there was a consultant who was working with CMHC. He was an architect. And I want to say Greg Allen, but it wasn't Greg. It was a different Greg. And I'm going to blank on his name. And he says that he wrote about house as a system for a CMHC report.
Okay.
And he thought he should have gotten more credit. And if he's out there listening now, he can fill in the name and you can interview him. But
yeah,
he was one of the R2000 trainers as well. And I just happen to not recall his name at the moment.
I mean, these are the kind of little rabbit holes that I'm very excited about diving down and finding a bunch of new stuff to me. Like, I, you know, like who came up with that term. And I know that, you know, Harold Orr was the person who really started saying, build tight and ventilate right.
Yep.
And that's taken off. That's some, you know, lots of other people have claimed that, but I think that, you know, we could just pass it on back to Harold. And I'm very excited. I think there's a bunch of stuff that I haven't had time to research yet, because there are a bunch of people that I didn't work with directly. But I do know that I sat through presentations by them, that their names were on all of the research reports that are sitting in my ramshackle library of CMHC and EnerCan reports that go back to like 1986.
Hopefully you've got all of those CMHC hard copy or an electronic.
I do.
Because much of that was purged. I don't know if you're aware, much of this was purged out of CMHC. The lawyers decided there was too much risk in giving out advice. And so any document that hadn't been formally reviewed by CMHC in the last 5 years was instantaneously pulled out of stock and sent to the dumpster. So it's not like it goes out of date, but they sort of said, if you're not regularly updating, then you have a responsibility to pull. And so as a consequence, huge numbers of publications were pulled. There's almost no advice from CMHC. And why? Because CMHC is fundamentally becoming a banker. It's not technical.
Not research anymore. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely been some big changes. And yes, I do have huge numbers of technical reports. Literally, I have seven bookshelves downstairs that are, I think they have, you know, they're like 30, 40 inches wide, and they have maybe five or six shelves on each of them, and they are jammed full of all of these things. And I haven't, every once in a while I go, oh wait, I think I have that report. And I go rummaging downstairs and I find it. And then I can say, look at, y'all are talking about indoor air quality. And this particular thing was done in Canada in, 1989 or whatever it is. And so, I mean, I think it's a real shame that we have lost so much of that really good quality research and historical context, because now when people are coming into this world, it feels like it's all brand new again, and people are having these aha moments, and every once in a while, we've already done this, and CMHC had, we had the indoor air quality specialist program that Virginia Solaris and her team built up. And that work was amazing. And it was so ahead of its time in terms of where the industry is now.
You, I know, would have dropped in the CMHC on a regular basis while there were still researchers there. But it was quite a revelation to go into these researchers' offices. We're always fearful when you were in them. They might cave in on you because there was immerse themselves in studies and literature papers, and we don't have any of that. And CMHC. Now I'm going to quote some older statistics, but CMHC makes $1.5 billion out of the housing industry. There's no government agencies actually make money, but CMHC makes money. CMHC makes money through its reinsurance program. And what I've never understood, like $1.5 billion, that's 1,500 million dollars, $1,500 million. And you would have thought that there would be, at it, if nothing else, 10% invested back into research. But what happens is, the money goes back into the public coffers, and then CMHC has to apply for the money back out again to operate its programs. So it's not like they get to benefit from the money that they make. The money that they make actually just goes into public coffers. The government has stopped investing in housing. The whole area where we, here we are, we have a housing system that's teetering, because what's going to happen with the interest rates? And then we have the whole affordability crunch. And arguably, we needed to be doing a whole lot of work through these past few years to anticipate and work on these kinds of issues. And
yeah,
fast housing is supporting the modular housing industry, but I'm not sure. They're just doing pretty conventional stuff when they could be doing some sterling work.
Yeah, I think that there are, and you've been involved with the prefab part of the industry for quite a while.
I got called upon to go in and work with numerous manufactured housing companies. One of the ones that Gord worked with, the Royal Homes in Ontario. I worked quite a bit with Guildcrest,
right,
in the Ottawa area. And Guildcrest, the president was David Pupor, and David was president of the Manufactured Housing Association. So he invited me to come and speak at a couple of the conferences. I've been a big advocate this last while where I can of suggesting that a manufactured housing plant is actually a trade school in disguise.
Mm-hmm.
Because yes, we've got all these modules coming through, and everyone's got to be wired and drywalled and roofed and framed and taped and painted. And every one of those could be a designation. And you could just, a trade school and a manufactured housing plant are a match made in heaven.
Okay, now I have yet another thing that I got to put into the hopper for me to get in on. Because that's a great idea, and love that. I mean, I could use the example of my son did a trades program in high school last year, when they could, they were able to actually do a whole thing like a manufactured plant, where they started with the framing. They did the framing, and then they had 16 kids in the classroom, and each kid got to build a whole wall system. So everything. So Jeff's got to do the framing, the wiring, the plumbing. You know, it was not obviously not connected because, you know, they're not official tradespeople. But he got to see how everything went together, all the systems. And I'm super excited because he's going to take our training for EA work.
Nice.
He's been hired he's out of high school now, just graduated. And he's going into to work with a renovator here in Nova Scotia, and he's going to do that work. So that's exciting. But that's kind of a digression from where we are today. But the thing that I'm really missing from my little exploration of the history of where we've been and where we're going is the mechanical side of things. I really, I had this totally peripheral experience of that, and it was all basically about presentations and stuff, because I was not in Ontario and I didn't get to see the test houses and I didn't get to go to the labs and stuff like that. So one of the names that sticks out for me is Skip Hayden
was over at KenMet. I first ran into Skip because he did a lot of work on systems,
right?
So I was pretty involved. I started the Products Association, so I used to do quite a bit of work with Skip there.
Right.
In the early days of R2000, we were trying to understand furnaces, HRVs and things. Skip being over at the left, our go-to guys for mechanical systems. And I'm not sure where Skip is these days, but I bet you he's still in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll have a look. Is there anybody else who you can think of who is in the mechanical area that would be a good guest?
If you could get Mark Riley,
Mark Riley.
The reason there was an R2000 program, in truth, Mark made it happen. Mark's father was an assistant deputy minister. And there were sort of three guys at R2000, Charlie Fichtner and then Mark, and Mark knew how to push paper and get money out of the system like nobody else. And at one point I can recall they suggested that Mark had like something like 380 contracts he was managing. He just made stuff happen, and I don't know how it all would have happened if Mark hadn't been there. Mark went over to KenMet just as he was leaving Natural Resources Canada. And his right-hand guy when he was there, because he was working on an integrated mechanical system at that point.
Right.
And it was Kevin Lee, who's now the president of the Canadian Home Builders Association, was Mark's right-hand man over there. That's where I met Kevin the first time. With Mark, because I had Mark come in and do a presentation at one of our camps. Mark is absolutely key to understanding R2000 and how it worked and how things happened.
So I came into the world of building science and R2000 just as Mark was, well, he was still involved, but really, my interactions with him were very superficial because I was working for Terry then. So I didn't have sort of like, constant contact. But yeah, his name is all over the place when you start talking to people about how did we get here?
and the other person was Keith Hansen. I don't know if I mentioned Keith's name. Hansen sort of ran the home builders' involvement in the R2000 program. Really was part of the success of the R2000 program, to my mind, was the partnership between government and industry.
And right.
So Keith was absolutely instrumental playing industries and successfully with government. And Keith is in Saskatoon. And he went on to become hugely involved in warranty programs.
And mm-hmm.
became the president of the International Warranty Association. The Americans. He's the first guy I know was in the housing industry that set up a foundation in Saskatoon to build affordable houses. Now we're going back 15 years ago, and he started wanting to build affordable houses because he says his carpenters were being priced out of the ability to buy a house. And how is it possible that a carpenter can work for him full time and not have enough money to buy himself a house to live in? And so Keith was, he and I went, we flew from Toronto and we flew down to the New Brunswick Home Builders who were having a conference, and we couldn't land in Fredericton. There was an ice storm. So we sat together on the way down, and as it turns out, sat together on the way back. And then sat together on the way back down because we couldn't land, went back to Toronto, stayed overnight, and flew in the next morning again. So I spent quite a bit of time talking about this affordability thing with Keith at that time. But Keith and Mark were really key guys.
Yeah, cool. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I'm going to do for the next season, because I want to definitely get your thoughts on it, because what I'd like to do is I've done this sort of broad-based overview of the context for building science and how did we get here, but I want to take a couple of deep dives into things like the indoor air quality piece and mechanicals and programs. So we can really have all of us who listen to this podcast are all, super geeky. But to know where things are and then get the, conversations with all the folks who are involved in that and where they see things are could go or should go versus where they are going. Maybe, some really interesting insights. And then we'll just keep playing with that part of it and interviewing as many people as possible. And then have the same kind of pattern where we talk about history, talk about things that are in our way, and then have conversations with people who are really breaking new ground.
Talking indoor air quality, and R2000 didn't have a lot of stuff, but it did have a list right from the
very beginning.
And it had indoor air quality. And I just sat in on, I'm a voting member on the National Building Code, and I just sat in on a meeting where, radon is still such a topic. And
yeah.
The first people that worked on radon were absolutely the R2000 guys. And boy, when you think of all the pieces that its longevity is absolutely tied to the fact that they had the right people and they got the right stuff in place. Because that's what gave it its legs, and that's why it's still such a core element of all of the energy programs around the world.
That's
why Oldenher went to the UK with Canadian Building Science, and it's why he's still doing work in Korea. These folks are hungry still for that information, and we actually forgot much of it.
I guess part of what I would hope that this podcast and the work that I'm doing can actually be one of the things that gets us, gets more of the industry excited about all of this stuff and hungry, like the UK and Korea, for more information and get it out, because we're really not going to get very far with codes. You know, code is behind what we know about building science by, what, 5-10 years? And building to code means you're just legal. And as we're moving up the scale in terms of the tiered energy code nationally, there's going to be a lot of, there's going to be a lot of messes in there. We know how to avoid them.
I'm on a committee with numerous others to look at unintended consequences. So as we, as we make decisions, how do we head off the collateral problems or the unintended problems that might emerge from this? And boy, it is, there's a big, long shopping list of things gone through.
Yeah. And I think that there's a, that shopping list gets longer and longer the more you start diving into retrofits. And you know, there are things we know are going to happen. If you build a new house like this and do these things, this is going to happen. But when you start to put insulation on the exterior of existing walls or do air tightness of, you know, air sealing work, and you don't benchmark it with forward door tests, and you don't know this and you don't know that about it, there's going to be, there's a whole, I can't even think about the messes. But it's really one of those things that I, when we're doing training stuff, what I was taught basically from you and Oliver and all the other folks who I was involved with the training is you always give examples and you always give those challenges. Like, what is going on here? And how do you think you're going to be able to fix it? And try and gamify that whole training piece. Like, okay, so if you do this path, yay, you got good things happening. If you do this path, oh, sorry, you burnt down the house or you killed all the people in it from, you know, you just asphyxiated everybody.
Yep.
Let's do it in games versus real life. That'd be really nice, I think.
Well, you've got an interesting season of podcast ahead of you. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, and thank you so much for coming back on and doing this little, this introduction piece for me. And I will talk to you soon.
Thank you for tuning in. This episode was produced by Blue House Energy, Podcast Atlantic, and Tanya Media. Subscribe and don't miss an episode. Leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time.